Thank you for joining the Buckeye Justice League, where we fight to keep sacred the spirit and principles of the Seventh Amendment for Ohio victims. My name is Jeremy Burnside. I am not a podcast professional. Like you, I'm a trial attorney, and I sometimes feel that I'm fighting a losing battle. Also like you, I fight for a change in the Buckeye State civil justice system. I'm proud to call myself a trial attorney and proud to host this podcast. It is my intent to keep you up to speed with some of the latest issues we face in our practice, which issues directly affect our clients. It is also my intent to keep you motivated about the good work that you do in the face of significant resistance. Every once in a while, it's nice to hear stories from others to remind ourselves that we are not fighting this battle alone. We have a great show lined up for you today. We will be talking with Southern Ohio and Northern Kentucky attorney Matt Nakajima about ERISA health insurance subrogation and equitable defenses to these claimed liens. As the U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon case gets interesting, I figured now would be a good time to brush up on this topic, which increasingly dominates much of our time and frequently throws a monkey wrench in the quest for justice for our clients. So load up that nagging motion you've been pondering for the last 3 weeks. Crank up the volume on your Datsun as you drive to court, or light up that cigar that's been stinking up your desk drawer, because it's time to lace up with the Buckeye Justice League and our guest, Matt Nakajima. All right, Matt. Hey, I wanted to just kind of give a brief introduction to Matt before we get into it. I have that he is a graduate of Bellarmine University. He studied economics and graduated in 2004, went to Salmon Chase Law School, and received the Magnum Cum Laude Award, Order of the Curia, Law Review, and Moot Court. And he's currently licensed in the state of Ohio and also the Commonwealth of Kentucky, and also the several federal court jurisdictions. He is also a member of the Kentucky Justice Association, the Ohio Association for Justice, Salmon P. Chase, American Inn of the Court, American Justice Association, Kentucky Bar Association, and the list goes on. And Matt, here's the question I want to know. How did you get so involved in ERISA and subrogation?
First off, let me thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it on the podcast. As far as getting involved with subrogation reimbursement, I think it's a regular part of any plaintiff's lawyer's practice that you're going to have a subrogation interest come in and request money out of your client's settlement. And the way I got involved was I followed the listserv on both the Ohio Justice Association and the Kentucky Justice Association. And then every time there was an opportunity to attend a seminar, I just took advantage of it and then continued to try to perfect my craft on how I would go about negotiating or eliminating subrogation liens.
And right now, I mean, you've done a good enough job that you're now the co-chair for the KJA Subrogation Committee. That's a pretty big deal, man. That, to me, that tells me that you've done a lot of research and you know your stuff.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm honored anytime anybody would ask me to speak. Being a co-chair is a real honor for me, and I am working with a gentleman named David Abney out of Frankfort, Kentucky, who, in my opinion, is probably the foremost expert in subrogation and reimbursement defense on behalf of plaintiffs and injury victims. So I'm just honored to be working with him.
And Matt, I'm gonna tell you up front. You know, I've been practicing personal injury law for about 10 years, and what started off as probably about only 10 to 15% of my practice dealing with subrogation has now since become something like, gosh, 50 to 60% of my practice. What's happened over the last 10 years that has turned so much of not only, you know, my attention, but other attorneys all across Ohio and Kentucky, their attention on this issue of subrogation?
Well, I think the laws have really changed. And it started, as you mentioned, in about 2006, about 8 years ago, Sereboff versus Mid-Atlantic Medical Services came out by the United States Supreme Court. And in there, they changed what constituted appropriate language for a plan's right to reimbursement. And it started out with being a relatively non-issue, and then some subrogation reimbursement attorneys realized that they could kind of create a market niche by taking some of the United States Supreme Court decisions and using that as a revenue stream to start contacting health insurance companies and hospitals and using these decisions in order to obtain money for the insurance companies out of injury victim settlements. And as the last 8 years have continued to go by, the Supreme Court has unfortunately come out with more and more decisions in favor of allowing insurance companies to take away settlement proceeds of injury victims. And it's gotten to the point now where there's fewer and fewer equitable defenses for injury victims to utilize in order to fight insurance companies' rights to reimbursement. So that's why you're seeing it as a larger part of your practice.
Yeah, and that's the main reason why I had you on the show is because you've helped me. You don't know this yet, but I'm telling you right here for the first time, you specifically have helped me with a big problem I had on my hands. Involved a very nice lady who sustained some very serious hip injuries in a bad car accident. Her health insurance company sought $60,000 as ERISA carrier. They wanted $60,000 in subrogation for her medical bills, and there was only a $25,000 third-party policy. So I communicated this information to the insurance company, and the insurance company, the ERISA carrier, they come back and they say, well, we're still pursuing our full $60,000. And I'm scratching my head thinking to myself, there's no way. I mean, what is going on here? You know? So then I start thinking back to all the equitable defenses I thought we had, and I know that have been either watered down or eliminated. And, you know, I remembered an article that you had published, I think it was in the Ohio Trial Magazine, regarding the common fund doctrine. And I use that as my first line of defense didn't work. So then I contacted you again, and you gave me this fantastic game plan on how to protect my client's rights and at the same time make sure that she could keep her health insurance and all that. So I want to start with that. And before I start, I want to say thank you. You've put a lot of work in, and that significantly benefited my client, who as of yesterday was told that of that $60,000 ERISA lien, they will take $1,000, and that means that we don't have to litigate that issue or further argue about it. My client's going to get a nice big fat check for about $20,000. There was some med pay in there as well. So I wanted to say thank you, and with that, I wanted to ask you specifically, just tell the audience about how you approach each ERISA claim when it comes to preparing some type of argument against them when they seek reimbursement.
Sure. Well, first off, let me just tell you that was a tremendous result, Jeremy, and I'm sure that your client's very thankful. And on behalf of other injury attorneys, I'm very thankful that you would continue to fight for your clients, because unfortunately not everybody does. And as long as we as a group continue to fight to let people know and insurance companies know that our clients are going to be treated fairly, we can continue to get results like that. The way I would address attacking an ERISA plan, first off, is to try to determine what type of plan I'm dealing with. As I'm sure you know, there are two different types of ERISA plans. There are insured ERISA plans and self-funded ERISA plans. And insured ERISA plans are those plans where an insurance company bears the risk of loss. Self-funded ERISA plans are where an injury victim's employer usually bears the risk of loss. And the distinction between those two is very, very important. If you're dealing with an insured ERISA plan, both federal law and state law applies. So you can use state anti-subrogation statutes and state common law in order to create defenses against having to reimburse the health insurance plan. If you're dealing with a self-funded ERISA plan, in those situations, you're limited exclusively to federal law, and the Supreme Court decisions and rulings on what you can and can't use is equitable defense. So once you figure out what type of plan you're dealing with, then the first thing you need to do is request a copy of the actual plan documents. And if you're dealing with an insured ERISA plan, that's often going to be called the master group contract. So you would want to write to the plan administrator and request the master group contract. And if you're dealing with a self-insured plan, you would be requesting the actual plan.
Now, is this something, man, I don't mean to interrupt. Is this something that we have our name on the letter? Or is this something that you want the client to request specifically? And do you recommend certified letter? Tell me about that.
I would always recommend that the client send out the request for the actual plan documents. The reason that you want that to happen is that it can trigger a $110 a day penalty after 30 days of non-compliance by the plan administrator, which can be used to negotiate down the lien. And in order to trigger the $110 a day penalty, you would need to write to the plan administrator, which can usually be found on the summary plan description, or oftentimes you can just ask Rawlings or Nginx or some of these third-party collection companies who is actually employing them and who is the plan administrator for the plan. And you would send it by certified mail, assigned by the client, and after 30 days go by after receipt, if you have not heard back and received the plan documents that you requested, then a $110 a day penalty starts to accrue.
Okay. All right. So what's the next step? What if, other than this $110 dollar penalty, what further steps would you take to, let's say you secure a settlement? All right. What steps would you take to perhaps, if you're thinking about just giving the client the money, what steps would you take to protect the client from any further involvement from the ERISA carrier demanding subrogation?
Well, normally when a settlement comes in, I will put the client's money, not normally, I always put the client's money into their IOLTA account. And then I will write the plan, let them know that the case has been settled. When a case is settled, the plan's right to subrogation, the right to step into the shoes of my client, are eliminated. So then the plan's only right to get their money back is through their contractual right to reimbursement. And I will let the plan know that in order to determine whether they actually have a right to reimbursement, I have to get a copy of this written agreement that they're citing to in support of their right to get reimbursed out of the settlement. And I will usually give the plan a period of time in order to respond. And I'll do that with follow-up letters, reminding them that I have sent a formal plan request under 29 U.S.C. 1024 requesting the actual plan documents. I'll let them know that the $110 a day penalty is continuing to accrue. And then I'll put a final date upon which I either have to receive proof that they actually have a legal interest in the settlement in the form of a written contract, or I will then just disburse the funds to the client.
Okay, I'm going to throw you a curveball. What if the liability insurance company says, we're not cutting a check until we have the interest of the ERISA carrier protected, either by them cutting a check or sending a check to you with their name on it? What about in that situation?
You know, Jeremy, that's a very good point. And unfortunately, there's no right answer to it. If the tortfeasor's insurance carrier is holding the money and they refuse to disburse it to you until this ERISA lien can be resolved, you're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. More and more, I'm seeing exactly that situation where the Rawlings company or Nginx or some third-party company will send a notice to the at-fault insurance carrier saying, hey, we have a statutory or some type of ERISA right to reimbursement. But what they won't do is send any written agreement that proves they actually have the right. And in situations like this, if I can, I will ask that the at-fault insurance carrier send my client the portion of the settlement solely in their and my law firm's name to me, and then send any amount in dispute, which the ERISA lien holder is claiming a right to reimbursement to, send me a check in the client's name, my name, and the ERISA lien holder's name to me so that we can hold the funds. And that's the goal. And then once we hold the money, then we have a little bit more leverage with the ERISA carrier to, you know, put up or shut up, if you will, about producing the written agreement.
And I've got a couple questions for you. Let's say I remember looking up this issue about 10 years ago, and I came to the conclusion, the way the law was then, that the only penalty my client could have would be suffering the insurance company dropping them. But now there's all kinds of penalties left and right, ethical penalties. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. There's different penalties to different people. For your client, if they do not protect the interests of the insurance company that paid their medical bills, then there is the threat that they could lose their insurance coverage. In my experience, over the last 6 years, that's been an empty threat. I've never once seen that happen, but nevertheless, it is a legitimate threat that could theoretically occur if a client did not protect an insurance company's interest or alleged interest. You're starting to see more and more that where a plan does have proper reimbursement language, that they will actually go out and sue their own insureds or intervene into the personal injury case to pursue their own interests. But in situations,
or they can sue you, they can sue the other insurance company. It just really creates a big mess, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think the scariest thing is the fact that they can sue the personal injury attorney. And that was in the Sixth Circuit, which governs Ohio and Kentucky. There was a decision called Longberger versus Colt. It's a 2009 case in which an attorney was actually hit with a judgment to have to reimburse the health insurance plan of his client because he intentionally ignored an ERISA plan's lawful right to reimbursement and disperse the money to his client without setting aside some of the money to pay the plan.
I mean, that's really opening yourself up to not just a big mess and a big headache, but just something just by ignoring the ERISA lien or not properly addressing it. It can, to me, in my practice, and I know a lot of people some people may disagree with it, but making sure my client keeps her health insurance is important to me. Making sure that they don't get sued is important to me. Making sure that I don't get sued is important to me. But that now there's something else after 2011, this ethical opinion, and it's opinion 2011-1 issued on February 11th, 2011. And when I first read that, I felt to myself, okay, this opinion solely dealing with hold harmless letters, meaning I can't send a hold harmless letter to the insurance company saying, hey, go ahead and send me the check with, I know that Medicare is involved, I know that there's a ERISA plan involved, but send me the check and I will agree to hold you harmless. When I first read that opinion, I was like, oh, well, that just deals with that. No more hold harmless letters. The insurance companies aren't taking them anymore anyway. No big deal. But then I read this language, and I apply this to ERISA, and I know other people have as well. In short, a lawyer's ethical duty is to protect a third person's lawful interest of which the lawyer has actual knowledge. The lawful interest must be in the specific funds in the lawyer's custody. Matt, has this ethical opinion in 2011 compounded the issue we have with ERISA and the decisions that hurt us there?
Absolutely, Jeremy. And I think that is an issue that's had to be addressed by all Ohio personal injury lawyers when dealing with ERISA liens. But I do see parallels between the Supreme Court decision, which is U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon's, and this ethics opinion that you're referencing. Specifically, in U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon's, the United States Supreme Court said that summary plan descriptions that just summarize ERISA plans, they don't mean anything. They're not controlling. They have no authority. So any language in a summary plan description that says an injury victim must reimburse their insurance company has no authority. So the court made it very clear that the written agreement that had to be in place is the actual plan. So that's why it's so important to get the actual plan, because now the only document that the insurance company can bring, unless your client just signs a letter guaranteeing payment after the fact, is the actual plan. So when you look at under the Ohio ethics rules, there's a rule called Professional Conduct Rule 1.15, Section D. And in there, it establishes what interests a lawyer must protect of third parties. And in particular, it specifically states that a lawyer shall protect the interests of a third party if there's a written agreement by the client or the lawyer on behalf of the client guaranteeing payment from the specific funds or property. And then, as you brought out, everything turns on, does this third party have a lawful interest that the lawyer has actual knowledge on? And I think there's a split on what constitutes actual knowledge in a lawful interest. My position is that a lawful interest requires that the plan produce the actual written agreement in the form of the actual plan that specifically states that their own insured, my client, has to reimburse the plan. So in situations where I continue to ask time and time again for the plan to produce the written agreement or the plan that supports this plan administrator's claim that my client has to reimburse them, if I never get a copy of this written agreement, then I don't think I have any actual knowledge of any lawful interest that I have to protect.
Yeah, boy, that is some pretty significant ammo that I feel is definitely effective in attacking what I think is a real injustice to our clients. I mean, I don't know about you, Matt, but when I have to address these ERISA liens, I kind of feel like an indentured servant, meaning I'm working for these health insurance companies for free, essentially, and getting them a recovery. I will say that every once in a while, you know, if my strategy is if I'm getting ready to file suit and I think that their ERISA lien is going to be a big deal, I'll include the carrier in as an involuntary third-party plaintiff, which usually triggers an immediate phone call from Ingenix or Rawlings or the attorney for them saying, hey, we'll knock off one-third of our lien, in which in turn I usually say, well, I have no idea what's going to happen with this case. You might have to sit in for the long haul. Or if I think it's a good deal, I'll tell them, my litigation rate's 40%, make it 40%, and maybe we can work something out. But Matt, I just wanted to get your thoughts on dealing with these carriers when you're in litigation, and specifically, is there a deposition that you can take of a plan administrator to try to sidestep these liens?
Good point. And I think it all depends on what the goals are. You know, if you add them in as a third party or as a real party in interest plaintiff, then you do have discovery options available. And one of the greatest ways, as you pointed out, in order to reduce the lien is to make them actually do the work. So instead of us being indentured servants to them, the insurance company has to, you know, actually prove their own claim. And I think that has a lot of merit, and I think it's a great tool to use. And in those situations, if they are a party to the case, they are subject to discovery, and I would request copies of 5,500 forms. I would request copies of all the summary plan descriptions, copies of the actual plan in place that governs the rights between my client and the insurance company. And yes, you would theoretically notice the deposition of a plan administrator or someone with authority to speak on the plan administrator's behalf. And you would want to ask questions about how they determine whether they will reduce their insurer's right to obligation to reimburse. You know, there's a plethora of questions you can ask. Unfortunately, fortunately in my case, whenever I've noticed the deposition of the plan administrator, you will usually get a call from the opposing side's counsel, surprisingly offering to substantially reduce their client's right to reimbursement as long as we don't have to go through with the deposition. But yes, you can take them. But I think just the threat of the deposition is a great tool to get the plan to reduce the amount that they're requesting reimbursement.
And Matt, I, you know, I don't know, maybe it's an unorthodox strategy, but I tell the attorney for the health insurance company, I say, "Hey, man, you ready to litigate this?" And they'll say, "Well, what do you mean? Am I ready to lit? Are we ready to litigate this?" It's like, "Yeah, I mean, come on, you guys have interest too. You guys have to prove causation. You guys have to prove. Yeah, you guys have to help me out with liability. You know, you guys, come on, cough up some money here for these expenses to help." You know, to help our joint cause. And, you know, typically they don't like to hear that. And like you said, sometimes you get another call saying, "Hey, let's try to work this thing out." And, you know, Matt, it's just more and more frustrating. And I get so upset when the whole case rests upon a subrogation lien that 5 years ago I really didn't look too hard into because, you know, I didn't have to, number one. Number two, there was no notice. It was my position that if there was no questionnaire sent to the insured, that, you know, a lot of times there was no notice there, and that argument seemed to work. But all those arguments are out the door. And another argument that I think is out the door, and I want to get your take on, is make whole. Tell me about that and when it applies to or these ERISA liens.
Well, again, it goes back, Jeremy, to whether you're dealing with an insured ERISA lien or self-funded ERISA lien. As the United States Supreme Court has said in U.S. Airways, as long as the plan has the proper language in which it specifically states that made whole does not apply, then it doesn't apply. If the plan dots its I's, crosses all its T's, and specifically rejects all equitable defenses. When you're dealing with a self-funded ERISA plan, then you have no leverage. All equitable defenses are gone. But when you're dealing with an insured ERISA plan, sometimes you'll have additional arguments. And unfortunately, if you're in Ohio, you know, the Ohio Supreme Court has basically adopted the same standard to reject made whole as the United States Supreme Court. And so theoretically, if you're in Ohio and that's where the plan administrator is located, then you do not have make whole as a defense. Now, one thing that's really great about having an insured ERISA plan that's subject to both state and federal law is that sometimes you can argue that instead of Ohio being the state that governs the rights between, you know, your client and his insurance carrier, you can often look and see where the plan administrator has its principal place of business. Recently, I had a plan administrator that had their principal place of business in Pennsylvania. Well, Pennsylvania has anti-subrogation statutes that can be used to defeat even plan language. So that if even if you're in Ohio, always check to see what type of plan you're dealing with. If you're dealing with an insured ERISA plan, see where the principal place of business is for the plan administrator. And you might find that the plan administrator is in a state that has anti-subrogation statutes, which still allow you to use the made whole as a defense.
Matt, it can get worse, can't it?
Unfortunately, it will, Jeremy. I think that more and more plans are going to be using the most recent United States Supreme Court decision of McHutchinson versus U.S. Airways, and they're going to take the Supreme Court's language and they're going to strengthen all their plans to the point where there are no more equitable defenses when you're dealing with self-funded ERISA plans. And I think that we're going to get to a point where the only way we can combat that is to do what you said earlier. You're going to have to name the plans as a party to make them present their own interests, or, you know, we as a group. As a group of trial lawyers, we're going to have to get together and try to get some type of anti-subrogation statutes enacted either at the federal or state level.
Boy, that sounds like a great plan because, you know, I'm thinking in my head when you're telling me this, I'm thinking, boy, why do I even have my client bill their health insurance, have their providers bill their health insurance to begin with? You know, we have this Robinson and Jakes issue, but now I'm starting to think, boy, it might even be easier to just negotiate directly with the provider rather than dealing with the health insurance carrier.
And I think that that's what a lot of attorneys are doing. And I don't think that's a bad idea. I think it can save you a lot of time and headaches. And depending on how well you can negotiate and how reasonable the medical providers are, sometimes you can actually put more money in your client's pocket by avoiding ERISA altogether and just negotiating directly with the medical provider.
Well, Matt, you know, before we conclude here, I just want to again thank you for all the help that you've provided. Are there any good sources of information out there for the audience that you would recommend?
Yeah, I have a couple great recommendations. If anyone's going to be in the Northern Kentucky area in May of 2014, we have a great team, in particular David Abney out of Frankfort, Kentucky, who's going to be talking about the very detailed ins and outs of defeating ERISA plans from a language standpoint. And then even if you can't make it to the seminar, there's one website that I would strongly recommend everyone read up on. It is called ERISA with Professor Barron. And Professor Barron is a law professor at the University of South Dakota who in his free time devotes his professional life to helping plaintiffs overcome ERISA liens. And you'll find a plethora of information from equitable defenses that are available, how to use the statute of limitations to your benefit to defeat plans, and also form legislation that he's kind of recommended the states adopt. So I would strongly recommend going to ERISA with Professor Barron to learn more about how you can combat these ERISA health plans.
You know, to close out, that's been the Buckeye Justice League with Matt Nakajima as our guest today, is subrogation extraordinaire. And if you have any questions for Matt, I'll be happy to pass them along. You can email me at jeremy@jburnsidelaw.com. And Matt, anything else?
No, thank you for having me, Jeremy. And just keep up the good fight and just keep doing what you do.
You do the same. And thanks again, buddy. We'll see you.
You too. Take care.
And that'll do it for this week's show. I want to thank Matt again for taking the time to be with us. If you have any questions for Matt directly, he can be reached at his office at 888-547-1044. I also wanted to thank you for downloading our show. But do me a favor and say a few prayers that the little guy prevails in U.S. Airways versus McCutcheon. Our clients sure could use some good news on the ERISA front. Now get back to that motion. Pump up your Rocky IV soundtrack or put out that cigar. You've got some people to help. This podcast contains the opinions of myself and my guests, and the opinions hereon do not necessarily reflect those of our sponsors or supporters. The content shared on this podcast is intended to be a guide, not a substitute of your own due diligence. After all, our opinions on this show can always be wrong. As such, it is incumbent upon you to read the cases and statutes, check their statuses, and obviously consult with the ethics rules and opinions before relying on anything you hear on the Buckeye Justice League.